Mumble, mumble, mumble. Yes, I know. It's late. I get it. Well, it's nice to be back. My wife Janet and I had a chance to go down to Texas a couple weeks ago and do some ministry at a family camp. And one of the things that's really nice is that our oldest daughter, Sydney, was also a family camp counselor during that week. So we got a chance to minister with her, which was really fun. Part of the downside for me was trying to be there to hang out with all the dads, and all my kids are gone, and all these dads are younger, and so there's a dad game, and it was called Slam Ball, and it's a very simple idea. When you get a bunch of guys together, the object is just slam something really hard and make the other guy have some kind of pain. I think it's a big idea. So we were in groups of two, and you had this table out there, and you had a red playground ball, and you had to throw it on the table. And you had three chances to keep it in the air and two chances to dribble it, and you're just trying to work this thing out. So I'm there thinking, okay, I got to show up for this thing. And shortly within the game, there's a ball that hits the table. My turn, I go chasing after the ball. And I'm going so fast, I finally hit it. Did not hit it well, just kind of got a hand on it, but could not stop myself in time before I ran into this large water cooler with the big 5-gallon jug. So landed on my hip, slid into the thing, hit my head, tumbled out the big 5-gallon jug. I mean, it was like a cartoon, it really was. Found out later that I have massive bruise on my body. And luckily, there's four other dads that were kind of over-eager like myself. So it's when you get a bunch of dads together and get a little testosterone going, it's a little crazy. And I realized that, you know, I'm just not young anymore. And I'm not an athlete, either.
Did you get it on video?
No, I didn't, and I'm grateful, yeah. Yeah, I'm grateful. Sydney was a little embarrassed that it even happened. I said, honey, you weren't there. I actually got points for hustle. It's going to be okay. But it's so interesting, as the Olympics launch and we watch these people who labor so hard and work so diligently, and God's given them bodies and coordination and also their own hard work, it's impressive, isn't it? To just sit back and watch how they work so hard and how they come together and can perform so well. Apart from some of the snafus of the opening ceremony, the thing that was so interesting about it is to see that every year when we have the Olympics, it's the parade of nations, isn't it? They're coming in as a group, and they have the same outfits, and they have the same flags, and this time they're on the Seine River, and they're coming down in boats. But you can always count on the fact that all the athletes are going to come in, and they're going to parade themselves as nations. And what's so interesting is I was watching the opening ceremonies. I'm reading through the book of Matthew right now. And it reminded me of Matthew chapter 25 and verse 31. And Jesus said, "But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left." And it's interesting to just think that, is that really going to happen? I think it will. I don't know how it plays out. I don't know if we're going to come in similarly with flags and whatnot. Nations have lasted for a long time. It's not like he's just going to judge the last 20 years. But the whole concept of nations coming before him and being accountable to him was just sobering to me. And it's interesting, as we look at the rest of Nahum, I'm sorry, I didn't get the... Nahum, Bob, am I close? So, I did not catch that translation when I was in seminary, but I like that, or that pronunciation. But as we finish up the book of Nahum, I want us to think about that day is coming. It came from Assyria. And Assyria is an example for all nations to say that there's a God who will judge us as nations. And so it's meant for us to be an example to wake up and understand that that day is coming for us. So in light of that, how should we live as we look at Assyria? How is it that we should live? And we want to look at why the Lord judged Assyria and give us some ideas about how we should live. In chapter 1, we looked at the Lord's vengeance that was declared, how he's saying why he's going to come and bring his justice and judgment on Nineveh. Chapter 2, the Lord's vengeance was activated. And what we want to look at today is the idea that chapter 3, the Lord's vengeance is completed. So I want us to go through verse by verse, and I'm going to try to do this quickly and try to summarize some things, and then get into asking a couple questions. Why is it that God judged Assyria, And what is it that we can learn from it? So if you have a Bible, turn to Nahum chapter 3. If you don't, it's in the pew in front of you at page 825, or maybe it's on your phone. But in verses 1 through 10, we have a summary of Nineveh's downfall. Verses 11 through 19, we have some details of this downfall. So I want us to start with verses 1 through 10 for the summary of Nineveh's downfall. In verse 1, it says, "Woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. Her prey never departs." It starts with seeing the reputation of Nineveh, and it's not a pretty reputation. This is a bad place. It's done a lot of bad things, and it starts with recounting the reputation that Nineveh has. Verses 2 and 3, the noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheel, galloping horses and bounding chariots, horsemen charging, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, a mass of corpses, and countless dead bodies. They stumble over the dead bodies. In these two verses, we see it's described the destruction that's coming. And it's amazing how vividly it's painted for us. First, by just the noises. You can hear the horses. It's almost like Nahum can understand and see and hear and feel all that is coming to Nineveh. And it's loud, and it's noisy, and it's ominous, and it's powerful. And it's got vision. You've got all this metal that's flashing, these swords and everything that's flashing. It's a very busy, very destructive thing that's happening. And what's happening is all these people are going to die. It's amazing, this vivid picture that these corpses will start to stack up and pile up, and they'll be so thick they can't even get through there without stumbling over them. So this kind of destruction that's coming is very powerful and very ugly. Well, it gets to the motivation behind this. What is it about Assyria? What is it about Nineveh that required this? So verse 4, we see about her motivation as a country, really. All because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. The big idea here is just that she is an idolatrous nation. The idea of a harlot that's going to chase after anything she wants. And so it's not only that, but having another picture of this idea of the mistress of sorceries. So it's not only that you're just kind of doing whatever you want as a harlot. You don't worry about a covenant because you're a harlot. Same thing with a mistress. A mistress doesn't worry about a covenant, doesn't worry about obligations, doesn't worry about doing the right thing. And this is what Nineveh is. It's a place that doesn't care about who God is or what he wants of them. They're going to worship their own gods. They're going to do their own things. They're not going to abide by how he wants them to live. They have a different God, and they're glad to serve him. Verses 5 and 6 go on to say, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will lift up your skirts over your face and show to the nations your nakedness and to the kingdoms your disgrace. I will throw filth on you and make you vile and set you up as a spectacle." Here we see the description of her humiliation that's coming. And it starts by God saying very clearly, "I am against you. You have picked the wrong person to go against. I've seen what you've done. I know what you're about. And I, the Lord God, am against you." And the picture that's painted is really quite embarrassing. Here's this nation that's huge and proud and powerful and done all kinds of violence. And their skirts are going to be lifted up for everybody to see. That's pretty embarrassing. They're going to have filth that's thrown on them. They're going to smell horrible. And here you've got this idea, this powerful, powerful nation and powerful people that are going to be thoroughly humiliated. That's part of what God's going to do, is to show them that when they compare to him, they are nothing. And the power they think they have, the influence they think they have, will be completely embarrassed in front of not just themselves, but it's what's interesting is to the kingdoms, all the kingdoms. Think of all the kingdoms that they affected, that they came and marauded. They're going to be paraded in front of all these other kingdoms and be thoroughly embarrassed. And yet they thought they stood at the top of the ladder. Verse 7 says, "And it will come about that all who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. Who will grieve for her? Where will I seek comforters for you?" See, what's described here is her abandonment. Before, everybody's afraid of you. Everybody's going to be in a relationship with you because they don't want to get hurt. But you know what? When God's judgment's done, nobody is going to be there. No one will support you. No one will encourage you. You'll be left abandoned the way you have left so many other countries abandoned by how you've treated them. This is what's coming to you. Verses 8 through 10, he's describing a comparison. He says, "Are you better than Noam, which was situated by the waters of the Nile, with water surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea, whose wall consisted of the sea? Ethiopia was her might, and Egypt too without limits. Put and Lubim were among her helpers. Yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Also her small children were dashed to pieces. At the head of every street they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound with fetters." And in these three verses, what's being described is her arrogance. Nineveh's arrogance. Because the idea is that, do you think you're better than this country, this city, Noam, which really is a city of Thebes that was in Upper Egypt? And when you look at how Thebes was situated next to the Nile, near the Red Sea, it was just almost indefensible because there was so much that was there to protect Thebes. And Thebes itself was a powerful nation. So God is basically saying, do you think you're going to get away with what you did? When you look at what happened to Thebes, you're fooling yourself. And what's interesting is that it was the Assyrians themselves that destroyed Thebes. In 701, Sargon, the father of Sennacherib, invaded Thebes the first time in 716 BC. Then in 670 BC, Esarhaddon, who was the son of Sennacherib, again invaded Thebes. And then Ashurbanipal in 668 went in and, in a sense, finished the job. And so I'm almost like God saying, hey, you thought, when you looked at them, you thought you can take them easily. You don't think you can be taken easily? Do you have that kind of arrogance that you think nothing's going to happen to you and you can just take people the way you want? And so God is confronting this country, this city, on the arrogance they have about how they see themselves, especially in relationship to God and the world. So that's just kind of a summary. I know we walked through that quickly. I want to get to some of the details, and here I just want to kind of, just want it to fall on our ears. It's like, wow, God's judgment is heavy, it's clear, and it's severe. Verses 11 through 19, we see the details of Nineveh's downfall. Verse 11, her false refuge will fall. You too will become a drunk. You will be hidden. You too will search for a refuge from the enemy. Like Thebes, you're going to search for help, and you know what? You're not going to find it. The refuge you think you're going to find, it's going to fail. There's going to be nothing that will save you from this. Verse 12, her fortresses will fail. He says, all your fortifications are fig trees with ripe fruit. When shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth. Isn't that an interesting picture? It's kind of comical, really. It's like when you think all the stuff that's going to protect you and you think this is a great defense that's going to keep the enemy out, you know what's going to happen? The enemy's going to come up to this thing and just give it a shake. And like figs, it's going to fall right into their mouth. You're going to be so easy to overtake. And here you think in your hubris, your arrogance, that you are you're defensible, that no one can get you. But man, they're going to come and push on you, and the fortresses are going to fail, and people are going to walk right through. Verse 13, her citizens will fail. Behold, your people are women in your midst. The gates of your land are opened wide to your enemies. Fire consumes your gate bars. Now, this isn't really a politically correct thing probably to say for Nahum when he says that all your people are women. Women are strong. We have women in our military. But this is certainly a reference to the idea that women usually weren't the ones going off into battle at this time. You know, God's even designed men with stronger upper body strength. That's why in a lot of ways men are going to be better at battle, especially here where you got to carry a big sword and a shield and some other stuff. I mean, all kinds of people can probably carry an M16 that might be a little lighter, but when you're wielding a sword and a shield, you got to be a little beefier. And he's basically taunting them and saying, all of your men are powerless. It's like you're sending out a bunch of women to try to protect yourself, and you're going to get mowed down because the citizens that you put out in front are going to fail. And what's going to happen is these gates are going to bust out wide open and walk right through with fire. Verses 14 and 15, her efforts to defend herself will fail. He says, draw for yourselves water for the siege. Strengthen your fortifications. Go into the clay and tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. There, fire will consume you. The sword will cut you down. It will consume you as the locust does. Multiply yourself like the creeping locust. Multiply yourself like the swarming locust. And so interesting, he's trying to say, do everything you can. Yeah, get as much water as you can. Fortify yourself. Try to make your numbers bigger. Try to be like locusts that can actually multiply and create a bigger defense for yourself. Make more bricks because the bricks are going to fall down. But you know what? Everything you do is not going to work. You're not going to have enough water. You're not going to have enough bricks. You're not even going to be able to multiply enough to take on what's coming after you. So try as hard as you like, but all those efforts are going to fail. Because God's judgment is coming on you for how you've treated him and others. Verses 16, her economy will fail. You've increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. The creeping locust strips and flies away. And just as a locust is going to do its business and get out of there, the merchants who've come to Nineveh, because it was a trading route, there's a lot of money to be made there. When the pressure starts coming, they're out of there. They're not going to support the economy. They're not going to support the war that's going on. You're not going to be able to get their riches. They're just going to all be gone. Just like locusts, when they're gone, they're gone. Verse 17, her militia will fail. Your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts. Your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers settling in the stone walls on a cold day. The sun rises and they flee. And the place where they are is not known. So when you look at all the strength that Assyria has had in Nineveh, there are marshals, there are generals, there are army people, but they're not at war. They're just in the city. And just like when a locust is going to go and hide in this rocks to rest in this season, they're all there, but they're not doing anything. But as soon as the sun hits them, they scatter. They're gone. And the idea is that, yes, you have all this military, but man, when the heat comes, they're gone. You're going to say, where did they go? They were all here. What happened to them? Because it will be as if they didn't even exist, the kind of judgment that God's going to be bringing. Verse 18, her leadership class will fail. Your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles are lying down. Your people are scattered on the mountains, and there is no one to regather them. As the king looks around for all the people that support, where are they? They're sleeping. They're not at their post. They're scattered. There's going to be no one to gather people and say, hey, let's take this wall. Let's take this wall. No leadership is going to be available when God's judgment comes upon them. They will not be able to rally and gather direction and leadership to fight off what's coming. And lastly, in verse 19, her defeat will be cheered. There's no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you. For on whom has not your evil passed continually? That when this judgment comes, there will be people who rise up and applaud their downfall. They will be so grateful that Nineveh has been wiped out. They will celebrate how much pain Nineveh is experiencing because of all the pain that Nineveh gave out. It's as if everyone's going to come by and clap and say, you have gotten what you deserve, Nineveh. And so this picture, this whole chapter is just heavy, heavy picture. That God's judgment is coming. And there's a reason that it's coming. And he lists the details of just how thorough this is going to be. In 612 BC, the Babylonians joined the Median king Syaxares, and they encamped against Nineveh. They laid siege to the city and finally broke through the defenses and began plundering and burning the city. Remember what the picture was, that the gates are going to bust open, that fire will come in and ravage. And that's exactly what happened. As this siege broke the walls, they just came in like locusts and did everything that was described. Because God said, I'm going to bring judgment to you. And I like how Mark referred back to Jonah. Yes, judgment is coming. By God's grace and mercy, he postponed it. But you know what? It's still coming. And that's what we see, is that God honored his word. He did what he said he was going to do. So after this destruction, Nineveh slowly began to disappear. It's nowhere to be seen in history after a period of time when the city disintegrates and gets thrown around by different leaders. Well, it's in modern-day Iraq is where we would find Nineveh. And the first archaeological dig that discovered anything of Nineveh was found in 1842. This place was erased. Because God says, you cross me and my holiness, there's consequences. And not only am I going to do that to you, I want the nations to know who they're dealing with. Not because he's mean, because this is who he is. And that's why I want us to look at, really, why did God bring judgment on Assyria? What was it about? Well, there's two reasons. The first one is to avenge his beloved Israel against Israel's wickedness. We know that Assyria was a wicked, notoriously wicked country, and especially how they went after people and the tactics they use in war were just atrocious. They were idolatrous. They were murderous. We see that in chapter 3, verse 1. They're a city of blood. Assyria was an enemy to Israel, took the northern kingdom into captivity in 721 BC, then kind of came back down a little further and tried to do the same thing to Israel in 701, but God prevented that. So this is an enemy of God's beloved people. And God says, I'm going to rise up and defend you because that's the promise that I gave you. Abraham, that's the promise I gave you. Remember in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, he said, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And what's interesting is we see the loyalty, the love of God for his people. And we belong to him. If you know Christ personally, that's exactly where he thinks of you, that he's going to take care of you. He's going to provide for you. He's going to protect you. Now, he might allow us to go through some suffering. He might. There are Christians who have gone through suffering a lot throughout the centuries. There are missionaries around the world who are under persecution. But they're holding on to the hope that God is going to make this right because of the God that he is. So interesting, at the end of his life, Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 14, as he's writing to Timothy, he said, Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. The Lord will repay him according to his deeds. Paul had an understanding that God is just. That yes, I need to love, I need to forgive, I need to move towards people who hurt me, but there's still a God who's going to make things right. And the people that hurt us, the people that hurt God's people, there will be judgment. There'll be justice. And as you're going through things, especially if it's something at work, especially if it's a conversation with someone where you're feeling persecuted or attacked, know that God is watching. He's taking notes. He's going to have a conversation with the person that's hurting you, that's attacking you, that's making your life hard. Because that's who he is. He protects those that are his. And that's what he did with Israel. And he wanted Assyria to see it, and he wanted the world to see it. Assyria is an example to all these other nations that Yahweh is Israel's defender. So interesting how the Lord says when he comes back in Matthew 16 that he's going to be repaying people according to their deeds. And that's sobering. That God actually remembers what we do. He actually remembers how people treat each other. And he says, I'm going to repay them for how they acted. Now, as believers, we're saved from the wrath of God because of Christ. So that's awesome. That's wonderful. That's amazing. But God still wants us to love people the way he loves us. He's still going to look at us and say, how did you treat people? Because how we treat people really, really matters to God. And when God watches and saw Assyria and Nineveh, he says, that's stopping. Because you're hurting my people and you're hurting other people. Well, the second reason why God judges Assyria is that he's holy. He's holy. That's just who he is. He's not vindictive. He's not like, oh, I just got a couple of favorites, you know, I'm going to pick on you because you picked on mine. That's included, this idea of his loyalty. But at the core of who God is that he's holy. And three quick thoughts about that. His holiness really means that he's totally separate from his creation. God is separate from his creation. There are some worldviews and beliefs that say God is in all things. That's not the Hebrew version of God. Or that God is everything. He's not everything. God is separate from what he has made. And what's interesting about the word holy, the Hebrew word for that word is the word kadosh. And basically what it means is to mark something off, that something's been marked off, something that's withdrawn from common use and ordinary use. It's something that's special and unique that's set aside. And applied to God is that he's this being in the universe that there's none other like. There's no rival. He's not his creation. And at the core of him is this being that's magnificent. He's lofty. He's exalted. He dwells in incredible, glorious splendor. He's not the average guy. He's not the average being. He's not someone we trifle with. He's distinct. He's holy. He's set apart from his creatures, and deserves to be treated a certain way because that's who he is. It's interesting, we get that glimpse from Isaiah 6 when Isaiah walks in and sees the temple of God. It says, in the year that King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with a train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim were standing above him, each having six wings. With two, each covered his face, and with two, each covered his feet, and with two, each flew. And one called out to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of armies. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundation of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out while the temple was filling with smoke. And you see that picture and you go, oh my gosh, this God that we talk about and sometimes can pray to without thinking too carefully is this God that Isaiah is discussing. And this is the God who shows up to judge Assyria. You can't treat my people that way. You can't treat me this way. And what's interesting about the idea for me in the sense of holiness that God is set apart and he's just so lofty and splendor and all the things that I can't fully describe is there's few things in my life that help me remember his holiness that way. When I was growing up in our neighborhood, my neighbor that I played with a lot was a guy named Gary Bushkin. And Gary and his sister Lori and sister Anita, they were the only Jewish family in our whole neighborhood. I didn't even know what that meant, but I knew they were Jewish. And we'd play at their house all the time. Dad started an electrician company and all kinds of stuff. And so when I'd go over to Gary's house to play, what was so interesting is his parents were gone, but we'd play in the house, and we couldn't go into the living room. Like, I remember one time we were just going to cut in there and bring up something to play. He goes, well, get out of there, get out of there, get out of there. I'm like, is there a landmine? Is there a snake? What's going on here? He goes, we're not supposed to be in the living room. And I'm like, why? I don't know. My parents say I can't be in the living room. Dude, your parents aren't here. I know, but we can't be in the living room. It's like the living room is a separate place that nobody goes into. Nobody? I mean, like you never have guests or something? He's like, I don't get it. We just can't go in there. Don't go in the living room. And what's so interesting is for me, in my religious faith, my faith in Christ, is like, what are the things that are holy? I grew up in a church where you go to this building and it's a holy place. That's all you do there is you worship there. You know, it was a Catholic church. It was like there's a little box up front that there's only one thing you do with that box. That's for the communion. The priest would wear a certain kind of thing. Now, I know there's a lot of issues and differences between us, but it's so interesting to me when I go to church, my church is a gymnasium. There's nothing unique or special about my church. Now, in some ways, that's wonderful because God is everywhere. He's here. We can worship at any time. I get that. But what's interesting about for me is there's nothing that reminds me that he's holy and separate and distinct and special and needs to be treated that way. But that's who he is. And that's why he judged Assyria. And not only that, it's the idea that he's holy and distinct, but he's absolutely good. He's absolutely morally pure. He always does what's right, and he expects human beings to do the same. He expects us to be like him. He expects us to treat him with that kind of reverence. He expects us to treat each other that way. And when we don't, this is where his holiness and his wrath comes out, because he's just. And when he sees the way Assyria has treated Israel and others, he says, that's it. You're done. I need to step in, and you're no longer going to exist. Well, it's God's holiness that drives his judgment of Assyria. It's his commitment and his love for Israel that just drives his judgment. Well, what can we learn from God's judgment on Assyria? Well, first I want to just ask from the question and the point of view as a nation. We're a nation. We're going to show up one day at that time of judgment. Even though I don't know how it's going to work or where we're going to sit or what we're going to do or how it's all going to work. But America will show up there. And it's interesting to think of the question, what Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 18, 7 and 8, he said, at one moment I might speak concerning a nation or concerning a kingdom to uproot, to pull down, or to destroy it. If that nation against which I have spoken turns from its evil, I will relent concerning the calamity I plan to bring on it. Now, I am a very, very patriotic American. There's a lot of things that are going on today that really, really bother me. But I have to be clear enough to say, you know what? We're just a nation in a long list of nations that have existed. And we, as a nation, are accountable to God for how we live and what we do and how we treat people. And so the thing that I just want to throw out is this idea that Assyria is an example for all nations. So what is it that we need to learn as a country? A few quick things. One is that we need to repent from any similarities that we have to Assyria. In chapter 3, verse 1, he said, "Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims." So interesting, on one level, like Assyria, America is a city of blood. We're a city of blood. It's so interesting. You know that abortion has killed more Americans than all the combined wars that Americans have been in. American soldiers we've lost 1.45 million soldiers to all the wars, from the Revolutionary War to the Afghanistan War. 1.45 million soldiers we've lost. But since 1973, according to the Guttmacher Institute, abortions have taken the lives of 63.5 million babies. And that's America. That's what we do with our freedom. We say, I don't want to be responsible with my sexuality. I want to have freedom. I want to do whatever I want. And that means I'm going to kill this baby because it's an inconvenience to me. And it's honestly hard for me to think that the Lord is not going to do something about that someday. But on one level, we have that description that we're a city of blood that has to be stopped. Secondly, like Assyria, Americans are full of lies. We're full of lies. You know, we say murder is really okay because it's not really a person that's getting killed. It's just, yeah, it's interesting. If you follow this argument, people will actually say, yeah, we're ending a human life. I get that. I know. It's okay. It's a human life, but it's not a person. So we'll say murder is okay. That's a lie. We'll say lying is okay if it gets you what you want. This is what we see in our politicians all the time. They're going to stretch truth and make lies, and our news media is going to tell lies. Why? Because I'll tell a lie if it helps me get ahead. I'll tell a lie if it helps me get the job. It's okay. That's okay to do in America because it's just a little lie, right? We don't really care that God says thou shalt not lie because he's a person of integrity. He's a holy person. But for us, that's okay. Stealing is okay if you're poor. Or if it's under $1,000, yeah, it's okay. It's no big deal. There's insurances. Insurance will pay for it. There's no big problem with that. We can lie. We can steal. Marriage is not for life. It's not. If it just doesn't go right and you don't like the person, you know, you can start over. Divorce won't hurt children. Sex is not confined to marriage. So interesting, in the kerfuffle around the opening ceremonies, they interviewed the creative director that kind of established the opening scene that was on the bridge, if you know the controversy that's going on. And he said, as French people, we love how we want and who we want. Because that is France. We love who we want and how we want, and we don't care about morals or God. That's really the idea. Because in our country, sex is not confined to marriage. Marriage is not confined to heterosexuals. Sex is assigned at birth. You can change your gender. There won't be any long-term consequences to taking all kinds of cross-sex hormones. There's no problem with that. Personal freedom and happiness is the greatest human need we have. If we could just enjoy our freedom, we'll be completely happy. It's okay to hate people you disagree with because they're wrong and they're evil. And even the one that's going around now that's being debated, but there's a contingency in our country that relates directly to our passage, and that is Israel is wrong to defend herself. And so America, there's a lot of lies that are floating around. And we have to sort through those. We have to make sure we're not susceptible to those because that's what happened in Assyria. They're a city full of lies. Number three, like Assyria, Americans are full of plunder. This is so interesting. Credit and debit card fraud last year totaled $34.4 billion. Identity fraud came to $43 billion. Government contract fraud, depending on the year, vacillates between $233 billion and $521 billion a year. Particularly welfare fraud and abuse totals $101 billion in 2023. And when you look at people who use ransomware to go after businesses and try to trip them up, it's predicted that this year, 2024, $9.5 trillion will be spent on ransom. There's something in our country that says greed is good and money is God, and get as much of it as you can. And those are lies. Those are all lies. And this is what we live in. This is what we're swimming in. Like Assyria, we trust in our economy. Like Assyria, our leadership class is failing. They're failing. They're not going to be rally things. And so all of this comes to the fore is to just think of, wow, we are living in this place. How is it affecting us? How are we getting caught up in this as believers? It's so interesting. I want to read a quote for you. And just, I can't hear your answer, but I'd be curious to see who you think said this. Here's the quote. God gave us life. God who gave us life gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. Thomas Jefferson said that. And so he had an understanding, even though he was a deist and cut all the miracles out of his Bible, he still had this concept, there's a God, and a God is just, and a God will not tolerate nations that are immoral before him. So how does this affect us? Lastly, what can we learn as individuals about this? Well, the first thing is, if there's anyone here who has not responded to Christ's death for you, I want to strongly encourage you to do that. Because he alone is the one who's going to save us from the wrath of God. He's the one that saves us from the judgment of God. Because every one of us is guilty before God for how we've treated God and how we've treated other people. He will save us from God's wrath. The second thing is, what is it that we can do as individuals moving forward, as just citizens of our nations, as Christians who live here? So interesting to think about. In Genesis 18, if you remember, God is taking Abraham on a walk. And he's talking about, they're headed towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and they're talking about what he's going to do with Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Abraham starts to negotiate with God. If there's 50 righteous people there, because that's where Lot was, if you remember, okay, don't destroy this city because that's where my nephew is. What if there's 50 righteous people? God's okay, I won't destroy it. And Abraham just keeps going down and down and down and down and finally lands in 10. What if there's 10 righteous people there? God says, okay, because you asked, I will not destroy it. There wasn't 10 righteous people there. And God destroyed it. But what's amazing is that God with his remnant, he has a remnant all the time. And there are people in this country, and Shepherd's Gate is part of that group, that as we are trusting God to live righteous lives, who knows how long God is withholding his judgment on us as a nation because of our righteousness, because of how we're pursuing him, because of how we're building the kingdom. And so for us to keep being righteous and keep walking with God is so vital. God can bring his judgment at any time. But there's so much that can be said for our kids and their kids and their kids and their kids that God could use us to bring changes to this place and stay his hand of judgment. Well, for our sake and our kids and our grandkids, let me suggest three things that we can do. First of all is to model personal holiness. In other words, how do you treat God? Now, let me just say that let me ask it this way. How many of us are perfect in our Christian faith? I want to make sure I know who that's out there, because I know I'm not. I'm not saying be perfectly holy, because you won't be. But what I'm saying is that we all need to model this. We need to say, God, you're a holy God. You're a righteous God. I want to keep learning how to honor you and please you and how I live my life, how I walk with you, that I'll spend time with you. I'll spend time in your word. I'll create more of a space in my life and to put myself in subjection to who you are. Help me become that kind of person, because that kind of person affects lives. When we put him first, when we walk humbly with our God, it does something to us and the people around. So the first question really is, how is it that you're treating God? How are you doing in your relationship with him? If you're feeling distant from him, I get it. I've felt distant from him. If there's been sin in your life recently that's just tripping you up, I get it. I've had that. But because you belong to Christ, you can come to him, confess your sin, and you are just going to get right back on the horse with him. Do that. Don't wait. Don't wait. There's no sin we're going to present to him that you say, oh, wait a minute, I didn't die for that one. Forget that. No. Wherever you're at, come to him. Submit yourself to him day after day, moment after moment, and model and live a holy life. Secondly is model righteousness. And the idea there is, how is it that you treat other people? Not only how we treat God, but how do we treat other people? Especially those that you disagree with. Especially those that make you mad. How do you treat them? Are you treating them fairly? Are you treating them kindly? Are you helping them when they don't deserve your help? It's so interesting. I'm just seeing this theme so much more lately that, yes, God is going to judge us based on our relationship to his son. But it's also clear he's going to judge us by our actions, by our deeds, and he wants us to be consciously working to love people practically. And how are we doing that? And lastly is to model a personal witness, and that is really how I discuss these things, how I discuss these issues with people. Am I sharing God's perspective lovingly? That's the emphasis. Am I sharing God's perspective lovingly? I'm the first person to get in an argument because I love a good argument. And there's some real nut jobs out there that need to be argued. And they're going to come at you with heat, so the natural response is to come back at heat. And that's not going to work. And that's not even how we're admonished in Scripture. Paul said in 2 Timothy 2:24, he told Timothy, the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, skillful in teaching, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. And Peter says something similar. In 1 Peter 3:15, he says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, but with gentleness and respect. So people need to hear the truth of the gospel. They need to understand God's morality. They need to understand what human flourishing is about, why God made human beings and how he made human beings. They need to hear that, but they need to hear it with gentleness. They need to hear it with respect. And so my last quick three thoughts as we move towards a lot of stuff going on in our country, especially this political season, I want to suggest a few things. You can disagree with these, totally fine. Just don't throw anything at me until I sit down. So, first thing that I want to suggest is that you don't defend a candidate. It's not about a candidate. Now, it is. I get it. But it's so easy that once we start going after a particular candidate, we can either build incredible bridges or blow things up. So, I want to suggest that you delay that for a while. So don't be feeling like you have to defend a particular candidate. Secondly, is don't defend a particular party. Now, I think that if you look at the two parties, there's cases to be made, and I get that. But if your immediate response is to defend your team, it can really put up those bridges. It can really blow things up. So I'm not saying these things aren't important. I'm just saying don't immediately make that your starting point, to defend a person or defend a party. But the idea is that you discuss a biblical worldview, that you'd have conversations like, do you think there should be rights and wrongs in our country? What are some rights and wrongs? Do you think it's okay for us to agree on things that are right and wrong? Would you agree with that? Do you think we should punish people who are wrong? Should we punish people who break the law? See, now we're talking about morality. Now we're talking about God's values, what God expects of human beings. And then you can move forward and start to talk about, are there people that will do that better than others? Another thing is about human flourishing. What are we made for? What are we designed for? How do men and women get along? Why are men and women different? What happens? You know, why do children need a home and a mom and a dad? Can you really change your sex? Is that really possible if you're honest? So all I'm trying to suggest is that we talk about the morals of the kingdom, the vision, the perspective of human beings. And as we start that, I hope that we're going to find that there's more common ground we really have with people. Now, as soon as we get to the team, the party, and as soon as we get to a candidate, things can go sideways. But by God's grace, if we start on this level of just trying to find agreement about things of morality, find agreement about things about human beings, what makes life better for all human beings, there might be a better chance for us to represent the kingdom and to help people understand there's probably better people to lead our country over time. So that's my suggestion. But the idea is, it's very clear from Nahum that God is going to judge the nations. God is going to judge us. And thankfully, by his grace, Christ has saved us from his wrath, but he still wants us to walk with him, to be holy, to be righteous, and to be his witness where we live. Let me pray for us. Father, I just feel really not humble. I think there's a part in which I just feel really small when I think of how big you are and how powerful you are. And I think that when your judgment comes, you're not going to yell and scream at people. You're not going to lose your cool. You're not going to flip your wig. But you're going to state very clearly who you are. And we will know who you are. We will see you highly exalted and lifted up and dwelling in absolute splendor and majesty. And we will know immediately that we are nothing like you. And that is really scary. But thank you so much that you have saved us through Christ, that because of him we stand in your presence. Because of the cross we stand and talk with you. And thank you that you will never leave us nor never forsake us. That's your promise. The way you defended Israel is the way you will defend us. Thank you so much. And Father, I pray that you will help us just a little bit each day to embrace more of what it means to follow you, to submit to you, to become like you, to live righteously, to treat people the way you want us to treat them. And Father, I pray you bless our conversations, that as we have these conversations about things that are wrong, things that we deeply care about, will you help us to go about it in a way that builds bridges? Because I think there's a lot of people who don't like what's going on. There really is. Will you help us start there? Will you help us move towards a biblical picture of life and humanity? And once we've gone there, then what are some next steps to see that happen in our country? So we just ask for your mercy and your grace on us. In Jesus' name, amen.